Please call the case.
Case number SCCQ-17-474, Hancock v. Kulana Partners and Fidelity National. Arguing for the appellant, Kulana Partners, Jade Lynn Ching. Arguing for the appellant, Fidelity National, Eric B. Levasseur. Also appearing for appellant, Fidelity National, Ryan H. Engel. Arguing for the appellee, Tim J. Hogan. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, counsel. Are you all ready to proceed today? Okay. So, Ms. Ching, you're going to start out with 10 minutes. Mr. Levasseur, 10 minutes. Mr. Hogan, 30 minutes. And we'll give you a warning with five to go, and then we'll have 5 minutes rebuttal for each for Ms. Ching and Mr. Levasseur. Please proceed.
May it please the court. Jade Lynn Ching on behalf of Kulana Partners, LLC. We have before this court two questions certified from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. One, whether a claim relating to a forged deed is subject to the statute of limitations for fraud. And two, whether the recording of a deed provides constructive notice in an action for fraud. I will be addressing the first question, and Mr. Levasseur for Fidelity will be addressing the second. It's important to note that the Ninth Circuit is coming to this court for guidance and for direction. And as such, this court under Cornhusker has the discretion to consider other issues it determines relevant. And you may, in your discretion, reformulate the question and respond how you believe is appropriate. So let's start the discussion here. In my early years of practice, I tended to see the law as fairly black and white, with some shades of gray. But as time has passed, and I think you will all agree, in your experience, with the benefit of experience, the benefit of trial, in some cases literally, the benefit of error, literally.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Ching, but following along the notion of getting help from you because of your experience, is this a forged deed? Was there a forged signature?
I would submit, Your Honor, under the facts of this case, no. It was not a forged deed. Under the facts of this case, it's a fraud. And we know this because Au instructs us to look not at the labels of the claim. Au versus Au instructs us to look beyond what the litigant places on the label of the claim. We look at the underlying facts, and we look at the pleadings to determine the underlying nature of the claim.
Ms. Ching, if you're saying it's a fraud, then why wouldn't the 6-year statute of limitations apply?
I think the 6-year statute of limitations does apply, Your Honor.
From
HRS 657-
6 years from what date?
From the date of accrual, Your Honor.
And what date is that?
In this case, it would be the date of recording of the deed.
You're indicating co-counsel, Fidelity's counsel will be arguing that issue?
That's correct.
You're not going to address that issue at all?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So in keeping with Al, this case is not a forgery in the sense that Mr. Hancock's signature...
Could you address Mr. Hogan's case? He suggests there are cases which would suggest the deed is void and there is no statute of limitations. I think the Palau case, and I believe it was the Hightower, I think. I'm sorry, but could the two cases?
Hoftaley,
pardon me. I'm so sorry. What's your response to those two cases?
So Palau was not a true forgery case in the case that the court considered or construed whether statute of limitations should apply to a forgery. In fact, in Palau, it was a standing case. The court was to determine in a case of, I think it was either eviction or ejectment, whether that party had an interest in the case. Did she have standing to pursue the claim of forgery? And the court ultimately determined that she did not. She did not have standing in that case to pursue the claim. And I think it was Helimanu Land Company was the defendant. So even though she had a claim and she was claiming forgery, the court never reached the issue of statute of limitations. It simply said, even in spite of the fact that she has this claim of forgery, we're dismissing the claim because she doesn't have standing to pursue it. So that brings us to the issue before this court. How do you recognize, as I think Justice Nakayama was getting to, about the application of the statute of limitations for fraud, and why should it apply to a claim of forgery? And what we've seen is, in the cases that we presented to you, the vast majority of cases construe forgery claims as fraud claims and apply the statute of limitations for a fraud.
Okay, so putting aside for a moment the question of whether the filing could be constructive notice or however you want to phrase it, would there be a discovery rule? Isn't there generally a discovery rule for fraud claims when the fraud should have been discovered? And should that rule apply here?
I would say yes. When a claim, it's an accrual issue, when they knew or should have known of the wrongful act.
Okay. And you're saying the filing was the one they should have known?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, and if I may, if I would suggest the pleadings of this case, what the allegations are of fraud based upon his complaint.
Well, let me ask you this. When you buy a piece of property and then do you go ahead and search the record after it's filed to make sure it reflects all the paragraphs that were in the deed that you signed?
I think typically,
the conveyance that you signed?
Good question, Judge. Typically in a transaction, you will receive a copy of the recorded deed. You receive a copy.
Not upon recordation, though.
No, not immediately upon recordation, you're correct. But you will receive, say if the transaction is escrowed, you will receive a copy of that deed that was recorded.
Are you saying that Mr. Hancock received a copy of the deed?
I am saying based upon the pleadings, he has indicated that, Judge, no, I can't answer that question. No, I can't.
Because of this.
Actually, you know. You represent. Oh, I'm sorry. You don't know. Fidelity knows.
Well.
Well,
know,
what's the record? What is the record of the case? At the moment, does the record of the case show whether that's happened or not?
The record of this case before this court for the Ninth Circuit, it does. That record is not reflected.
Right. It's a motion to dismiss / motion for judgment on the pleadings.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Correct. It's a different record. At the ICA with the Fifth Circuit, but that's not before this court. So getting back to his factual allegations, it's not a forgery in the sense that his signature was fabricated or that I signed the signature to his deed. This is different from those cases that Mr. Hancock has presented to this court, where, for example, the Moore matter, where the grandmother really is, that deed really is forged. She did not affix her signature to it. She did not assent to the transaction. She was not aware that this transaction was occurring.
Ms. Ching, does it make a difference that forgery in our state doesn't include just signatures, but whether there's an alteration to a written instrument?
I believe you're referring to the criminal statute,
right,
Your Honor, and I would suggest that the criminal statute, because we don't recognize civil forgery, has no place here. Mr. Hancock has not drawn the connection between why the criminal statute should apply in the civil context and how the criminal statute aids him in this wrong. How is this a true forgery when, in fact, he negotiated to sell this property? He assented to the transaction of the property. He voluntarily participated in the transaction. He signs the deed at escrow, and he accepts nearly $2 million for the purchase of this property. These are facts. These are factual allegations that are in his complaint.
Suppose the deed had actually given him it had been altered in the sense that it actually inadvertently he would have retained a small portion of the property. It didn't. The meets and bounds say were wrong, so he actually retained a little bit more. Do you think he'd be arguing forgery?
Do you think he would be arguing forgery?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. I think there's clearly some other underpinnings and undercurrent going on in this case that has motivated the filing of the case, but...
Forgery has to do with a false signature to a document. That's not what we have here, is it?
I would agree with you, Your Honor. This is not a case in which there is a false signature. We have a party who has assented to the transaction, who has reaped the benefits of this transaction, and who, by his own admission, acknowledges that KPL is in possession of the property.
They have the easement? I mean, the easement was granted?
In are you referring to the easement?
Well, just talking about when you're saying underpinnings and undercurrents, are you saying the judgment against Mr. Hancock? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, I'm referring to the $165,000 judgment against Hancock. And and ultimately, the Fifth Circuit determined that Mr. Hancock's and Mr. Grimpitz's claims were, they ruled in KPL's favor.
Shall we hear from Mr. Levesser at this point, and then we'll hear back from you again at
Thank
the end?
You.
Is that all right?
Yes,
okay,
absolutely.
Very well. Mr. Levesser.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Your Honors, Eric Levesser on behalf of Defendant Appellant, Fidelity National Title and Escrow of Hawaii. Your Honors, as my colleague, Ms. Ching, indicated, I'm going to be addressing the second question that was certified by the Ninth Circuit, which is whether the recording of a deed provides constructive notice in an action for fraud. Your Honors, we would submit that the Court should answer that question in the affirmative and find that where there is a public recording of an allegedly altered or modified deed that provides constructive notice of an action for fraud where that fraud is disclosed on the face of the deed.
So to the seller. Now, do you think we should distinguish, or I gather you think we should not distinguish between situations of constructive notice to the world at large, potential buyers, lenders, as opposed to the seller of the property? Aren't there different policy considerations going on there?
Your Honor, I think, as you just recognized, I wouldn't draw that distinction. Because I think if you follow the rationale of the Markham line of cases, when a deed is publicly recorded with the Hawaii Bureau of Conveyances, that deed provides notice to the world. That is a holding that I think is consistent across this Court's decisions, the Intermediate Court of Appeals decisions, as well as decisions from the District Court for Hawaii, so that when that deed is recorded, whether you're the buyer, seller, grantor, third party, whatever the case might be.
So you're saying that your client should benefit from, if the allegations are true, that he signed a deed with a property description that included easements, and then your client altered the property description to delete the easements. If those allegations are true, you're saying that you should benefit from the recordation of a altered document.
Your Honor, Justice McKenna, I'm not sure I'd say that we should benefit from that, but I'd say when you're looking to craft the rule of law and whether or not a party should be on notice of a recorded transaction.
Why should our case law, Adair versus Hustis, we say that the recording of a deed is notice merely to those who are bound to search the record. So you're saying that a seller who signs a deed in escrow has a duty upon recordation to try to get a copy of the deed that was actually recorded to see if it comported with what he had signed?
Your Honor, I'm saying in the context of this case.
Even if the escrow company changes the deed?
Correct, Your Honor. What I would posit.
Why would you have such a duty? Isn't escrow duty bound to file what the seller signed in escrow?
That is true, Your Honor. By the same token, if for whatever reason that did not occur, what I would posit in position is that the seller of the property, once that deed is recorded, is charged with notice of what in fact.
Why? How are they duty bound to check, to try to? Isn't that what escrow is for? You sign a deed, you submit it to escrow, they say this is what's going to be recorded on the closing date. You are now saying that, despite the duty of the escrow company, the seller now has a duty to try to immediately pull, go down to the recordation, go down to the bureau in this case, and try to take a look at the deed that was actually filed to see if the deed was actually what he or she had signed?
Your Honor, in response to your question, what I would say is I'm not sure there's so much a duty as the question is he on constructive notice?
Can I ask something about this? I just want to clarify. You are not saying you didn't have a fiduciary duty to the plaintiff in this case, to Mr. Hancock.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so you acknowledge that. So you know what I find a little bit confusing? Maybe you can clarify
sure.
this for me. Because your whole theory is that the public's on notice once it's filed. So that means you too. That means the escrow company knew that deed was faulty. You had a fiduciary duty and you concealed it. You folks knew, based on your theory, that the public, everybody in the public knows. So if we're going to give constructive notice, everybody's on constructive notice, which means you as a duty, you should have told them. Mr. Hancock, you were concealing it for 6 years or how many years? From the date that thing was filed, you folks were on notice under your theory.
Your Honor, I'm not necessarily sure I would agree because I don't think we're the ones contending that there was a modification, alteration, forgery, whatever the case might be.
You don't need to know that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You don't need to know that. You're just saying that as a public record, you're on notice.
Yes, what might help is when we talk about notice, I think we're talking about two issues here. You're talking about the fundamental Markham principle that when a deed or a document is filed with the Bureau of Conveyances, that document provides notice to the world. And what
so
I
you're
think
saying,
you then
you're kind of saying that you kind of don't care because the statute's passed from that date. So even if you were on notice, you're off the hook because the statute is passed?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is I think I'm answering your question by saying this, is that you then need to look to what is constructive notice. And constructive notice, when we're going to charge someone.
Your answer in the complaint said you were without knowledge as to exactly what was transmitted. If that's the case, then how could there possibly be a dismissal in this case? If you're on notice, that you're not sure, as Justice Nakayama just said, you have a fiduciary duty. You knew what was on there. You knew that you weren't exactly sure what had been transmitted, and you didn't say, hey, Mr. Hancock, there may be a problem here. You know, we just took a look because we're on constructive notice that just was filed, and guess what? There might be something wrong here. But did you folks make that call to Mr. Hancock and tell him?
Your Honor, to my knowledge, and I believe the record does not reflect that any call was made to Mr. Hancock at any point in time. I think to answer your question, Your Honor, yes, as I recall the allegation in the complaint that this was a forgery, that there was a fraudulent modification, that was denied as of the...
Am I reading this wrong then? That you stated you were without knowledge as to exactly what was transmitted? You're the fiduciary, you're not sure what was transmitted?
Your Honor, in answering the complaint at that time, I believe yes, that's what we would have alleged in the answer to Mr. Hancock's complaint.
What was your motion? A motion for judgment on the pleadings?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. So why isn't that admission in the pleadings, a part of the motion for judgment on the pleadings. You didn't know. How can you allege constructive notice to the seller and not constructive notice to yourself?
Well, because Your Honor, I would respectfully submit we are not the one bringing the claim. In terms of,
you're the one that filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings. Your pleadings become a part of your motion.
Absolutely, Your Honor, no question. And I have to believe that the district court, when it would have been ruling on that motion for judgment on the pleadings, would have taken the full pleadings into account. But I think the distinguishing factor here, I believe, Justice McKenna, is that, again, we were not the plaintiff in the case.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Please finish.
I'm sorry.
Now, I want to go back to my original question, which is, you know, constructive notice to the entire world. So my question was, I understand the purpose, the policy reasons behind notice to potential buyers, lenders. We have a system that enables people to determine when there are interests reserved in property, who owns the property. That's sort of the basis of our entire recordation system. How are those policies furthered or implicated with regard to the seller? I'm trying to understand what's the, and you can finish, what's the policy served by requiring the seller to go down to the bureau and check the deed himself or herself?
Absolutely, and thank you, Your Honor. I say I am out of time. Your Honor, I think the answer to that question is we want to prevent, it's the very reason why you have a statute of limitations, to prevent stale claims, that over time, witnesses will go away, will pass away. Evidence won't be what it was at an earlier point in time. So I think applying that rule,
why wouldn't a discovery rule serve that same end?
Well, I think that goes to this very issue of constructive notice, Your Honor. And if, in fact, I think you're dealing with a situation where you've got, you know, really a true forgery, where someone had absolutely no idea, was not involved with the transaction at all, as Mr. Hancock was surreptitiously had someone, the elderly grandfather or grandmother who's ne'er-do-well grandson.
Is there a statute of limitations issue when there's pure forgery? Isn't it void from the initial point? We're not talking statute of limitations when we're talking pure forgery.
Can I follow up on Justice Pollack's point just for clarification? Is it your position, Mr. Lavasseur, that if we just added one fact in this case, for that when the modification was taking place and the fraud was being committed, it extended to the point of adding a false signature. Under that circumstance, just with that one fact, you'd concede that no longer is there a statute of limitations.
Your Honor, what I would say is for constructive notice purposes, yes, that could very well change the dynamic. If it was a situation where Mr. Hogan's client, Mr. Hancock, had absolutely no idea. A rogue agent went out, forged his signature on a deed, went out.
Well, there was some rogue activity alleged here. It's rogue activity, I guess, to change the description of the property, so it doesn't include the easement. So if you just, I think we can use the term rogue from that point of view, right? Well, and that rogue activity could extend to also putting a false signature to the deed.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'm not sure I would agree, Your Honor. And I think that's where you need to draw the distinction. And that's why I think you look at these cases and the rationale. And I point particularly, I think, while the case is cited by Mr. Hogan, the Faison case out of New York, has a very interesting discussion, both in the majority opinion and in the dissent on this issue, as to sort of where you draw this line, when it's a, and what is unique about a forged signature versus perhaps a different scenario. And so we think, Your Honors, that the proper rule that would be crafted here is that if someone has their signature forged, if they have no knowledge of the transaction, if there is no, in the words of the Faison court, voluntariness of conveyance, if there is no assent of the will.
I think we understand that, sir. I'm trying to understand why that makes sense. I mean, I understand why we would say that we're not going to hold it against someone when they didn't even know the deed was filed, but the question is, kind of comes back to someone who did know it was filed but didn't know what was in it. But why don't we hold that for rebuttal? We'll move on to Mr. Hogan, and then we'll come back to you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Ms. Ching, thank you very much.
May it please this honorable court, Timothy Hogan on behalf of William Hancock, both individually and as trustee of the pension plan, Your Honor.
Very well. Good morning. Chief.
This is the softball case, because the one thing that we don't have in this case that would make this really complicated is an intervening interest, mortgage, subsequent transferee. That's the hard case. This is the easy case. The notary switched the pages. There's no evidence presented in the times this thing has been teed up that didn't happen.
Counsel, we're not here to address factual allegations, just the law.
But this case is dealing with simply whether this is a forgery. This idea of a true forgery being one where the signature is forged is contrary to law in this state, where the legislature has defined what a forgery is.
That's a criminal law.
Yes, Mr. Justice Pollack, it is. But would the civil courts addressing a criminal act want a different rule to apply?
Wait a minute.
We have that happen quite often.
And there's nothing indicating that this was, for forgery, let me take a look at it, but I doubt that an inadvertent action with no intent to steal money would constitute criminal forgery. If with intent to defraud, that's the criminal forgery. And I don't think that, at least I didn't see it, that there was an intent to defraud anybody in the situation. So that's another problem you have, that we're not even talking about actions here that would come within the criminal statute.
Well, if I may, Mr. Justice Pollack, the statute says falsely alter at 6 of 708.850 sub 6 is to insertion of new matter. And then it says a forged instrument.
You're skipping over. If with intent to defraud, the person falsely makes, completes, da-da-da-da-da. If you don't have a criminal intent, you don't have a criminal offense.
We don't know why they did, precisely why it was done, Your Honor. What we do know is a deed was signed, notarized, delivered to the escrow company for recordation.
Would you like your civil claim to rise or fall on whether you can prove criminal intent to defraud?
No, I would not.
I think maybe you shouldn't, at least from my perspective, I'm not sure how much it helps you to argue the criminal forgery statute.
Understood. Thank you, Mr. Justice. We're talking about the statute of limitations under Palau. I went back and looked at Palau last night. I figured that was the case that may get teed up, so I looked at it again, and they're confusing. And I admit that the writing is a 1914 case, but the deeds in that case were 1900 and 1901.
We've had subsequent cases in which we have held that where the deed that was signed was not what was intended, the deed should be reformed.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is the...
And in a case like this, let's assume that the buyer had no knowledge, that it was just the escrow company that substituted the deed. You are arguing for a proposition in which the buyer would be stripped of the property. You are saying the deed was void, we get the property back, right? That's what you're alleging here. Even though there was an intent to convey the property, and the only issue is whether or not the property description had been altered.
The property description is what you convey in a transfer. It's the Exhibit A. It is the...
I agree. I understand. But let's assume that there was a slight mistake in the property description. Are you arguing that if there's any mistake in a property description, the deed is void?
No, Your Honor. I think it's curat non curat lex. I had this case early on. The law does not bother itself with trifles. And I remember that from the first case I ever dealt with, and it was in this court.
What if it wasn't a trifle? What if it was something along the lines of what happened in, it's a little bit different, but Mejia versus Houston, in which the grantor intended to convey part of her property, but the deed that was presented to her actually conveyed her entire property, in which this court ordered a reformation of the deed to reflect the true intent of the grantor.
And that is within the equitable power of the circuit court, Your Honor, to do that. That is what the merger of law and equity has given our courts the ability to do, and is to reform a deed. I know we're not supposed to get into this case and go too far off, but I wasn't allowed to prove what happened. I think I'll be able to prove what happened, and I think the things that Justice Pollack is concerned with were at play in this case, Your Honor, but I never got to that. I was knocked out in a motion on the pleadings in which everything that I had alleged is deemed to have been true, and the issue that is now back to this court is whether or not a forgery has a statute of limitations. Whether we push it aside, and then maybe this esteemed panel is saying, well, maybe this isn't a forgery. The Ninth Circuit is going to simply want to know, and this court can do whatever it wants, but whether or not the Palau case that says it's void ab initio is still the law in this jurisdiction. And the reason I put in all that stuff with the criminal statutes and other cases was to say, basically, for my own.
What if we ruled that it's not? Then would you concede that it would be the fraud statute of limitations under 657(1) subsection 4?
I don't consider this a fraud, and that's just my own.
Okay, so what if we say that we are going to distinguish between forged signatures and changes in the property description? Then, if it's the latter, what statute of limitations would apply?
Well, I understand if you're going to rule that it's not a forgery, then there's nothing left really in the quiver other than a fraud. Although there's clearly been no holding out. It lacks the little pieces that we all learned to pass the bar exam that a fraud had.
No, would you agree? Oh,
I'm sorry.
It may be the same question. No. Justice McKenna is asking you, let's assume it's a fraud. The question is, when did the statute of limitations? Your opponents are arguing that it's from the date that the deed was filed. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that was my question too.
If it were fraud in the factum, I'm not in factum, fraud in the inducement, if I can just be specific, and it was this is a really good car and I'm going to buy it, it's when the transaction closes. So I don't know the case law on whether it's requisite.
You're
going to
concede
a discovery.
I'm sorry.
There's a discovery rule, which I asked, I think, Ms. Ching about, which is when it was or should have been discovered. Are you conceding it should have been discovered upon the filing of the deed, or if not, when would you say it should have been discovered?
Well, I don't think it's rational to conclude that filing the deed is suddenly going to tell you that since you last saw the deed, someone's changed it.
So you would not agree with them that there's constructive notice upon filing of the deed?
Absolutely not.
All right. So what's the rule that should apply in terms of when this claim begins to accrue? Assuming, and we totally understand, you strongly believe 657(1) doesn't apply. If it does apply, when does this claim accrue? In your view, how should we analyze that issue?
And I pondered this on the way over here, and here's my best shot. It's up to the judge to look at all the factors. It's numerous factors of what's reasonable under the circumstances, and no bright line rule will be sufficient to handle it. And this is one of those areas because it's an equitable choice and maybe an issue of fact, but was the person reasonable in their conduct? And I would offer that it's unreasonable to have someone stand at the bureau and watch to see if a deed coming in is different from the one that was delivered to the escrow company.
So when should the statute start to run?
When a reasonable person in the same circumstances would have reason to believe that the claim had accrued.
So please respond to Mr. Levasseur's argument that there's notice to the whole world when it's filed, that is the notice that should put people on alert that something has happened. Well, how do you rebut that particular argument?
If I could just digress to answer this question, I love the pure race world of Hawaii recordation. I'm one of the few people who actually run to court with a document to record it because my practice requires me to do that. I'm a bankruptcy trustee lawyer, and unless we record it, the debtor can transfer their property and create a good faith purchaser. It's in the code. So I've run at least a dozen times from the bankruptcy court to the Bureau with a document. That's all it gets, is notice of the existence of the document, not of what's in the document. It's what the pure race concept is for, to say, okay, lawyers, okay, title companies, here are the documents. Now look at whether you want to do this transaction. But
I'm sorry, but so you are now arguing for a position that says that a forged deed, like if somebody forges a signature and files a deed, the world has notice of the existence of that document? The owner of the property has notice of the existence of that document?
The subsequent purchaser does. If it identifies the property in the Bureau and says it's Tim Hogan's house that just got transferred, and that person goes out and says, wait, I think Tim Hogan's in bankruptcy. Wait,
that's the purpose of the recordation system, which you've explained to us. Why should that same rule apply to the seller, and if not, why not? That they're on notice as soon as that document is filed. The world's on notice. People who buy the property on notice. Lenders are on notice that the document is filed, or they're constructively on notice. Should that same rule apply to the seller of the property, and if not, why not?
If the seller had any reason to need to know whether the document had been properly conveyed, something that you would believe that someone with a fiduciary duty has already done for you, then those facts would be relevant. But nobody,
Is there anything alleged in your complaint that, in your view, raises such a duty here? Because we are here on a motion to dismiss. So what I think I just heard you say is there could be some circumstances where there might be a duty. I assume, are you suggesting that those circumstances exist here or not?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying is I tend to never cut anything off in terms of the world of black and white. And the reality is the pure race, Hawaii's rather evolved system of filing protects you from buying a property that is unmarked, that has a right that blocks your ability to be a good faith purchaser.
You know, I think I've just heard three different tests from you, and I'm not trying to quibble that not all of them may be viable, but the first one sounds to me like you argued that filing the document gives constructive notice of the existence of the document and not its contents, which is actually analogous to often when a court takes judicial notice of a document, it takes notice that the document exists and not necessarily the contents. That's one theory that you put forward, which is viable. The second one you just said, too, was that it's only if a person has a duty to search, which is actually very close to the Texas document. What Texas says is, under Texas law, recording documents and public records serves as constructive notice for statute of limitations purposes only for those persons who are under an obligation to search records. That's the second test that you've sort of alluded to. And the third test was when you said you as you were driving over here, which is kind of looking at the totality of the circumstances, and that's very close to the Nebraska test. There are also other tests, actually, as well. But there is a more of a recent trend to not, in many circumstances, to automatically apply constructive notice across the board.
And I believe it comes down to the facts of each case. Every case stands differently, and I've done enough of these somewhat bizarre cases to realize that the bright lines don't always apply. And I know that that's what the Ninth Circuit has asked for, is a bright line. But I think it's the idea of the few times I've had to deal with the tolling of a statute of limitation, whether it was reasonable, is a totality of the circumstances test. That is
well. Can I, while you're on your analysis of the test, then could you describe that in terms of what is the answer that you're asking us to provide to the Ninth Circuit? And are you conceding that the answer doesn't necessarily depend on the assumption that a forgery took place?
Dealing with what the Ninth Circuit is requesting, I believe that if the court is not going to find this is a forgery and void ab initio, that under the facts of this case, it would have been unreasonable for Mr. Hancock to have had notice of the fact that the escrow company changed his documents.
We're not being asked to respond to factual questions. We're being asked to formulate what the law is. It seems to me that you may be conflating accrual versus tolling. We're being asked, when does the cause of action for fraud, if this is a fraud case, when does it accrue? We're being asked to formulate a principle of law.
I understand, Justice McKenna.
And why wouldn't it be the discovery rule when the person knows or should have known that the fraud occurred?
I think that's what I was trying to say. That should have known is the idea that you've acted reasonably, but under the facts of this case, and I'm going to stick to my own case if I can, Your Honor, is Mr. Hancock had no reason to have known at the time. So
we have said, this court has said, that it's the deed gives notice to those, merely to those who are bound to search the record. So is that what you're arguing?
I'm saying Mr. Hancock had no
you had no duty to search the record at the time.
There was no point in doing that. And I've represented many people in real property transactions, and I've never had to go in and search a record for something we already sold.
Question. Is it, if fraud applies, is it possible that 657.20 basically extension by fraudulent concealment, would that apply here?
I've alleged that, I believe, in my complaint, that they had a duty to disclose as a fiduciary. It's different.
So it is possible that there could be different statute of limitations between the buyer and the escrow company.
Yes, I believe that to be true. There were a number of transactions, and there were people involved in it that we didn't learn about until, and in a discussion with Bob Grimpus, it became apparent that we were looking at two different deeds. That's how it happened.
Actually, no, but the statute does say that it doesn't just, the extension doesn't, does it just go to the person that actually concealed it? Or does it go to the entire world, any claim that might arise from that extension by fraudulent concealment?
I would expect it has to do with people who are harmed by it. I mean, no one else would care.
But it's not just the person that concealed it. It would, the cause of action would be extended to any, as to claims against anyone. What is your position on that?
Yeah, we're dealing with a fiduciary. It's a very high standard. And the fiduciary,
what about the buyer? Is the buyer a fiduciary?
The buyer was not a fiduciary. The buyer was a LLC, non-fiduciary, third party. And so the duty to disclose, and they do that now in the closing. They'll have this, they have a thing that they give you that says if we have to make changes, you'll agree, we'll give it to you. But the idea that you can take a recorded document, swap out pages, and file it. And the interest, it's not really before the court, but it's in the record. There were interests that had to do with things like native rights that were removed in the deed. And there were things that were warranty obligations that when you go and do real property transactions, you take the old Exhibit A, and you may look at it and decide, but you know that if there's a easement in the Exhibit A you took in, and you take it out, you violated the warranty obligations to defend those interests. So it's not just that it's a bad idea, it creates havoc in the recording and in the real property transactions. And we're talking about the escrow company, the people who insure the title, no intervening third party, nobody else that is going to be harmed by this. Those other cases where that comes up, those are hard. That's not the case that's here today. This was the last stop on this deed before recordation, and it got changed. And if you have other questions, I'm happy to field them. I'll just save the time I have. I
have one little really minor nit to pick.
Okay.
And that is, in the future, when you file your answering in your briefs as someone who still reads off the hard copy, I don't think your brief is in compliance because it doesn't have your name and address and attorney number on the front. And it's supposed to be part of the cover page. And I still read the hard copies. Okay, thank you.
All right. And anything further, Mr. Hogan, at this time?
No, nothing further.
Very well. And we'll hear from Ms. Ching at this time.
like to address Ms. Justice Pollack's question about the statute of limitations as it applies to a void deed. Because that's the policy, that's the issue, that's the gray area that we're working with here. That's the concern here. How do we reconcile application of a statute of limitations to something that we've already decided, that this court long ago decided in Palau, that a forged deed passes no title? And I think this is the struggle that we're having with in this case. And I think we've touched on it, we've talked about it a little bit. It's the accrual issue and it's the tolling issue. We can still harmonize our case law in this jurisdiction with the application of a 6-year statute of limitations to claims of forgery. And we can still protect true victims of fraud. We can still protect them with the discovery rule, with accrual, and with the tolling of the statute of limitations. So let me talk to you about a true situation, not the situation that we have here, but the true situation of the grandmother whose deed was forged by her grandson. She doesn't assent to the transaction.
Let me ask you to digress a little bit. I'm sorry to interrupt quoting Justice Wilson, but when you talk about a discovery rule, what rule are you talking about?
I'm referring to it. I may not be using it elegantly or technically. You know, when you knew or you should have known. Just in that very broad, general sense, when you knew or you should have known that you had a claim. And it's on a case-by-case basis.
I'm not sure.
That's contrary to the position that your colleague is taking. Case-by-case, you want us to look at the circumstances of the case. Under their position, once the deed is filed, constructive notice to everybody.
Constructive notice to those who are duty-bound to search the record. And under the facts of this case, Mr. Hancock was duty bound to search the record.
Why?
Because he assented to this transaction. He participated in this transaction. He was involved in the transaction.
That's true of every seller in the state of Hawaii. So every seller in a real estate transaction is now going to be under a duty to check the record. Is that your position? Every seller.
Would you be arguing that?
Residential. Home, condos, every seller.
You know, you got me there, Judge.
I'm not trying to get you. I'm just curious about what your rule is.
This is part of the problem of this case. I agree. It's not an easy issue to harmonize.
But you would say across the board, because there's no special circumstances here that raise a duty, you'd say it should be a rule across the board, or is there something special about this case that raises a duty that's apparent from the pleading?
I would say it's the latter. I'm not talking about, when I say case by case, I mean the application of the discovery rule and the statute of limitations is on a case by case basis. So for example, the grandmother.
So do you want to apply the discovery rule?
Excuse me?
Do you want to apply the discovery rule?
In this case, I do believe that Mr. Hancock was on notice of this transaction at the recording of the deed in 2000.
Do you want to apply the discovery rule? Regardless of when he was on notice, do you think the discovery rule would encompass the recordation?
I think it would.
But you're in favor of the discovery rule?
Yes. Okay. And I believe that, you know, we have another, it's in the record, it's not in the pleading. We have another component here that he entered into a settlement agreement regarding this transaction.
Does that have anything to do with what was certified to this court?
It has to do with whether the deed was or was not forged and his knowledge and discovery of that issue.
Well, those are issues for the finders of fact. We're just being asked to formulate what the law is.
But I'm still trying to work with you, and sorry to ask for this clarification, but you were talking about harmonizing, and it seemed that you were referring to the notion that we're going to harmonize the fact that statute of limitations applies to fraud and that it doesn't apply where there's forgery somehow. So are you, to complete your thought, are you suggesting now that no longer would we take the position that it's void ab initio, where there's actually been a a forgery, and that somehow we're going to harmonize it and start applying a constructive notice where there's been a pure forgery?
No, Judge. I think in a case in which there is a pure forgery, say, for example, where the grandson has forged the deed of the grandmother, and he's recorded that deed, and she has no knowledge of this transaction, and the deed has been recorded, but at some point she learns through circumstances, not about through the recording, but she learns in some other way that there is this deed that has been recorded at the Bureau of Conveyances. She learns about it, but she does nothing. And 6 years pass, and the grandson then conveys the property to a BFP. And that BFP now tries to take possession of the property. I would suggest in that situation, yes, the 6 year statute of limitations should apply.
Because of a BFP?
Because she knew, she learned of the forged deed at some point. She learned of the forged deed at some point.
Are you talking about statute of limitations or are you talking about latches?
I'm talking about accrual.
But what about Palau? It's a forged deed if it's forged.
I agree, Judge. And this is, so the second scenario is.
Can I'm just going to, one second. Where are we on the time? For both of them. So I'm going to ask you, I am going to give Mr. Levesque some time because we've been asking you a lot of questions, but I am going to ask that you kind of wrap up your argument, respond to Justice Nakayama's question, wrap up yours, and I'll give Mr. Levesque some time because we have eaten into your time with our question.
I agree, Judge. This is the struggle. But in a situation where the grandmother never learns, and that deed is recorded, she never learns of the forgery.
Knowledge.
Then there's no accrual, and it remains void. It remains void. But if she learns of it, I would think that, you know, the statute, we could apply a 6 year statute of limitations and the time period would run, and there would be accrual issues.
Anything else to wrap up at this time? Or?
Nothing.
Very well. Mr. Levesque, a couple minutes for you to address, to do your rebuttal as well.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate the court's indulgence with the additional time. Your Honor, I think the hypothetical that was painted by my colleague, Ms. Ching, is really kind of what we're after here. We're looking for a rule that would both protect the policies that underlie the imposition of a statute of limitations, encouraging timely claims, encouraging people to not sit on their rights, while at the same time protecting someone who is the victim of a true forgery, who would lose possession of their property. And I would agree with Mr. Hogan on one thing, Your Honor, that is a case-by-case determination. And the reason why I would suggest that is you need to look to Hawaii law on what constructive notice is. Your Honor.
Do you agree with your colleague that Mr. Hancock was duty-bound to check that deed, that's his duty. Otherwise, the statute of limitations, I mean, because the statute of limitations starts running from the very moment it's filed, so therefore he was duty-bound.
And, Your Honor, I believe that circles back to a question Justice McKenna presented to me earlier today, and I would suggest, Your Honor, the question is not so much is there a duty versus is he on constructive notice?
We have said that constructive notice only the deed gives notice for those who have a duty to examine the records. That's what Adair versus Hustis says. That's this court. That's not Markham, all right? That's this court speaking. So why does the seller under these circumstances have a duty?
And Your Honor, I guess I would circle back to the question I was addressing as presented by the Ninth Circuit is the question of constructive notice. And so to me, when you're answering the question of is someone on constructive notice such that they should pursue a claim, you need to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Do you tell all the folks that you handle, you know, all the folks when you're the escrow company, you put on bold letters on the conveyancing document, you have a duty to examine the document after you sign it because we may alter it and therefore you better check it once it's been filed, or otherwise you're going to be stuck. Is there that kind of thing in bold letters on the first page?
Your Honor, I am not aware of that being on the first page, nor do I believe that's
any place on the document
of this case. Not that I'm aware of.
What about the Chief Justice's question? Are you prepared to argue that every single seller in the state has to, we all have to go and look at our conveyancing documents after you guys have filed it to make sure you did it right?
And absolutely a fair question, Your Honor. What I'd say is, again, you need to go back to the rule of constructive notice, which is totality of the circumstances, as Mr. Hogan said. So when you look at this situation, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, you look at Mr. Hancock's pleading, saying these two paragraphs in this deed were central. I specifically reviewed these two paragraphs, paragraph 12 and 16. They were so important, they were going to provide this easement. When that document is then gone, it's recorded, there's no dispute he voluntarily participated in the transaction, intended to convey the property, that he was comfortable with ownership transferring to Kulana Partners. And then you couple that with the final, the real kicker here, Your Honors, I would submit, is this 2003 settlement agreement that he
reached. Is that in the pleadings? I'm sorry, is that, yes.
It is, Your Honor. In fact, I can give you the exact site. It's referenced at Jeff's 13-407, which then drills down into some additional documents.
Okay. So that's not the recording, though.
I'm sorry.
You're arguing the recording date is the operative date, right?
Correct,
so,
Your Honor. But
so you're saying that Mr. Hancock knew or should have known that someone in your office is going to switch the documents?
I'm saying under is the law of the state, Your Honor, when something is publicly recorded and the person is a party to that transaction, they're not being hoodwinked behind their back.
This so that means everyone in the state? I'm still trying to understand if you're saying this a case-by-case basis or it's every seller in the state.
Your Honor, I think you need to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, what is it about this case that causes there to have been a duty at the time it was filed?
Where I would draw that line, Your Honor, is, again, this is a situation where Hancock and Hogan, I get messed up. Mr. Hancock has alleged that, you know, these two things in particular, these two paragraphs, were critical to his conveyance.
So because he said there were two things that were important to him, he has a duty? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
That kind of raises the question about how good the trickery is of the escrow company. In other words, if you change the deed and an issue that's on the margins, that hasn't been negotiated, that hasn't shown by the record was of great import to the seller, then, from what I understand you to say, perhaps there would be an action that would lie in the sense of the discovery rule applying. But where you have negotiation that took place that suggests that the terms, in this case, the easement was very important, then naturally you'd come to the conclusion that there was constructive notice, if I'm following you.
And Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, where I would draw the line is the distinction between, is the alleged fraud apparent on the face of the deed itself, which we would argue it was here. Anyone could look at that deed.
And then but you're saying at the time it's filed, the seller has every seller in this state, or at least Mr. Hancock had a duty to go down to the Bureau to make sure that the deed that he signed was what was actually filed in the Bureau. Why in the world would we even have escrow companies then? Isn't that your duty? Isn't it your client's duty to file what was the seller signed in escrow?
Your Honor, yes, but by the same token.
So it's okay, but if you choose to defraud the seller is on constructive notice because you filed a fraudulent deed.
Your Honor, I guess where I would disagree there is the notion that there's an intent to defraud, and I think that's the issue.
Well, I'm not trying to get into the facts of this case. I don't know what happened. But the issue is, you're saying that the seller has a duty to be down at the Bureau and examining what your client files. Why would we impose such a duty upon sellers in this state? Why are we paying escrow companies?
Your Honor, I would say for purposes of the specific question of is he on constructive notice or not, the answer to that would be yes.
You know, This is a regular system property. Our case law says that even if it's a Torin system property, if the certificate of title, you can attack a certificate of title based on fraud. Even in a Torrens system.
And again, Your Honor, I would circle back to looking at the totality of the circumstances. And if you're in a situation where someone completely without their knowledge is going to be divested of ownership in their property, they had absolutely no idea this rogue deed, this rogue transaction was occurring behind their back. The rule we're proposing would protect that individual. But Justice McKenna, as you indicated, and I believe one of your first questions to Mr. Hogan, well, what if this is just a simple question of there being a mistake? And if that's the case, are we going to oust someone who is otherwise rightfully in possession of that property? And I think what's implicit in that question, Your Honor, is under that scenario, does the party not have an obligation to timely bring that claim? And I think that's the position we're presenting here, Your Honor, is finding that right balance. And we think what we've proposed strikes that right balance.
Sounds like a good note to end on. Anything further?
Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you to all of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.